Public Affairs will come to order. Good afternoon, committee. I'm trusting that we'll see a few more faces here in a few moments, but we need to accommodate the Secretary of State, who has bigger and maybe better things to do. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2575, and Secretary Bradbury, if you'd come forward, please. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for honoring my schedule. I have to go to a meeting of the State Land Board at 2 o'clock, so I really appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm going to testify very briefly, and I'm testifying in strong support of House Bill 2575, which basically was introduced by this committee at our request. And what 2575 deals with is really two contribution and expenditure report issues. One is to get a contribution and expenditure report prior to the primary on initiative petitions that are circulating. Right now, an initiative petition that's circulating doesn't have to file any C&E report until they've filed their signatures for confirmation that they have enough signatures. So basically what we're proposing here is that they have to file a report prior to the primary, so that when they're really into the major signature gathering process, that's when that really goes on, is in the last 2 months, that there would be a pretty full financial disclosure so that people could know who was supporting what. And maybe that would influence what they decided to sign or not. We don't know, but that's the theory. The other issue is that I think all of us have noted that we vote by mail now. And that changes, as all of you know very well, the election timing cycle, in that ballots go out, 18 to 14 days before the election, and our C&E filing schedule is based on all of us going to the polls and voting on election day. And so what we're proposing is that we not add a report, but just move back the date when you have to file your first and your second pre-election reports by 1 week, which would basically get people a majority of the information about contributions and expenditures before most of them are voting. So, and that's, I think, since our whole system is based on disclosure, that's the idea of this bill, is to basically make sure people have that information prior to casting the ballot. So that's the concept, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Do we have questions? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relative to the issue of disclosure, Mr. Bradbury, I know we have another bill that which is submitted also on mandatory electronic reporting. And I'm always wondering, in terms of the issue of disclosure, until you have mandatory electronic reporting or you have a system that works, just how much information will be available to the public? Because other than that, I mean, you will have the reporters going through and highlighting a few cases, but they won't actually have, unless they come here to Salem and visually inspect, they won't actually know who's contributed to whom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I think you've made a good statement in support of getting electronic filing so that you can get instant access to the information. It's clear that whatever coverage does go on by the media can only go on once the reports have gone public, so that we need to move the date of the report going public earlier, so that in fact the media at least is able to report contributions and expenditures at about the time that people are voting. You are correct that, you know, most people don't come here and get a contribution and expenditure report. They basically rely on what they hear in the media. Once we put it up on the web, that would be possible, but that's now down the road a little ways.
Thank you. I know you've got a ways to go, so we'll give you your leave. Thank
and I'll leave you with our very able elections director, Lynn Rothick, who I'm sure can answer your questions much more effectively than I.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lynn, if you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Be happy to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Rothick from the Elections Division, and I'm here to answer any questions or if you'd like for me to go briefly through the materials that I submitted. I'm trying to simplify what is a difficult language actually in the bill to tell you in maybe a little bit easier language what it is that the bill is trying to do. As the Secretary has identified, there's really two different concepts in this bill. Both of them are related to contribution and expenditure reporting, but in different ways. Section one is the change to the statute that would require all of the state initiative petition chief petitioner committees to file an additional report. Right now, as we said, they only file one report and it's due 15 days after the filing deadline in July. And now this report has to be filed whether or not the initiative is actually submitted for signature verification. Every single committee comes in with that report. And that is the only one, so it covers the entire period of time. Even if that initiative was being circulated for 2 years, that would be the one report. And the concept that we're trying to get at here is to bring to the public, and during the period of time when the initiatives are still circulating, one other report. We're not trying to make this unduly burdensome in order to keep down, for one thing, the fiscal impact on our staff, but we're asking or proposing that there be one interim report that would report all of their contributions and expenditures through about the first week of May. And just for convenience purposes, we set up their deadline as being the same day as the second pre-election to the May primary is filed, just because that's a day that a lot of people know when to file reports. And they would still have to file that final report in July. So it's just one more report. And the idea would be that there would be some publicity or some ability to find out who's behind the initiative petitions while they're still circulating. That's proposal one. That's maybe the simpler one. Proposal two makes the identical change in sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the bill. These are basically sister statutes that provide filing deadlines for candidates and political committees both at the primary and the general. That's why there's four. There's two for candidates and two for political committees. But we're making the exact same change. And what we're proposing, as the Secretary has described, is essentially to move the deadlines for the two pre-election reports that we now have. And for simplicity's sake, I'm going to call them the first pre and the second pre. You may know them by those names. We're proposing that each of those be moved back about a week so that the second pre, which is really the key one, the one that's right before the election, right now, as I'm sure all of you being experienced candidates know, that second pre is due the Thursday before the election. And the thought was that by the time the media reports come out on that Friday, to the extent that they're of any use to anyone, which we hope they're of some use or we're doing a lot for nothing, but that it's really kind of late in a vote-by-mail election to have that report come in that late. And so the thought was if we had those report come in the prior Thursday, that last full report, that it would cover most of the period of time when those ballots are out and people are voting. And in order to try to illustrate this, and I'm going to have to apologize if this is confusing to look at, I've actually tried to give you attached to the materials here a calendar. And this is the calendar for 2002. And it's a little hard to read, but the code that I didn't put on here, let me tell you, the top above the line in any one day is the current law, and below the line is what we're proposing for House Bill 2575, the change. And so maybe that will help you to see what the deadlines are, so that you can see that for instance, right now, October 7th is going to be the deadline under the current law for the last day to file first pre-election report. And the and if you'll look then on in the rest of October, on the next page, you'll see that the first day to mail ballots is going to be October 18th, 2002. The last day to mail ballots is going to be October 22nd, 2002. And what we're proposing then is to have October 24th be the last day to file second pre-election reports, so that those ballots have just arrived in people's homes. Now, the negative part of having that second pre come in that early is there's a fairly long period of time between that and the election, with a lot of activity going on, particularly by state candidates and measure committees. And so what we're proposing then, if you're currently aware that the law provides for a supplement to the second pre that has to be filed the day before the election for large contributions between the second pre and 2 days before the election, we're building on that concept to require that large contributions and large expenditures be reported in between the second pre and election day. This way, the public information will be there only for the larger activity. For someone who is running an unopposed campaign or is not spending a lot of money or receiving a lot of contributions, they won't be affected by this.
Excuse me, we do have a question from Representative Stoller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The large contributions and large expenditures, that limit is $500.
$500 from a single source in a single day. Yes.
How long has that $500 limit been on the statute? You know?
It's been as long as I've been working with the C&E laws. I mean, I think it's been there for some period of time, the $500. Right now, it's $500 during the entire period that the supplement to the second pre is an aggregate for the period. This would be actually, in some ways, less restrictive because it's only an aggregate in a single day. In other words, if the same contributor gave $499 each day after the second pre was filed, that would not be reported. It would be per day. Yeah.
Representative Duncan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can understand the extension of the dates in terms of reporting periods and also in terms of, particularly the issue about extending it just prior to the election. But what I'm having difficulty is the addition of expenditures. And the reason being that the reporting of contributions is actually letting the public know who is supporting a candidate. The reporting of expenditures in that cycle is probably, to be perfectly frank, letting the opposition know exactly what your strategy is in the final 2 weeks of a campaign. Because that is during the period when a lot of direct mail would be hitting, and there are very few direct mail pieces that would fit under the $500 mark, probably the very few that fit under the $5,000 mark in this day and age. Mm-hmm. So you would be, in effect, actually telling the opposition exactly what you were doing during the final 2 weeks of the campaign. What was the purpose of that? I mean, I'm being frank here.
Sure. Thank you for being frank, Richard.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, you're perfectly right. I mean, right now, once the accounting period for the second pre-election concludes, there is no more reporting of expenditures before the election. Currently, that day, as you can see on my second day of my confusing calendar, is October 27th. Which is a week and 2 days before the election. That would be the last day for which any expenditures would have to be reported before the election. I guess the thought was, and I'll defer to the wisdom of the good candidates who are before me who are more experienced at this, by moving the accounting period back a week to October 20th, that's a week of full reporting that we're losing, in a sense, that won't be available because under the current system you would get all those expenditures through the 27th of October, and now we're moving that back to the 20th of October. So the thought was, in order to not burden every committee by requiring a full third report, which we didn't want to go to, would be to have some reporting come in for the large expenditures. I mean, the advantage, disadvantage, it would be equal for everyone in the campaign. Obviously. So if no one's going to report it, if you choose to delete that part of our proposal and not require reporting expenditures, then no one will know it. If you choose to have it in there, then everyone will know it on the same basis. And so we just chose $500 because it matched the contribution level that we were proposing. But I guess I can't say that there's a huge amount of study that went into it in terms of determining that was the perfect amount. So I'm not suggesting that it has to be right there. But that is our proposal at this point.
Thank you. Further questions? Go ahead and continue.
Okay. Well, the main thing I just want to point out to you on the calendar for the last days is just to see how this is going to work. I'm hoping it's not burdensome to the committees, but I'll let you think about it anyway. Beginning the day that the last day to file the first pre-election report, which under the bill would be October 24th, 2002, The cutoff for that report is October 20th, as I just said. That's the last accounting day. So expenditures and contributions through that day have to be fully reported on the second pre. So beginning on the 21st through 2 days before the election, there is going to be this, I call it the daily supplement, because rather than it be one big supplement that you file on the day before the election, we're asking that those, in order to be available to the public, be filed each business day after the day. And these are just a one page. If you got one $1,000 contribution and that was all that you had to report for that day, you would fax in a page that just said $1,000 contribution. And that would be the report for that day. And that those would come in daily starting on the 25th of October through the 4th of November. That is the proposal. And that's basically because in order to accomplish what we started out to do with having the second pre move back to a place where we thought it was more logical, we really did not feel as though it was appropriate to create that window that was empty with no reporting in it at all.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Garrard.
Lynn, I don't know. I may just be speaking for myself, but on days where I know we were to the deadline of faxing information in, those were terrifying days for this candidate because you don't know whether your fax gets through. You may not be able to get through, period. I'm real concerned about a daily fax that's required and that some candidates may not even have accessibility to fax machines on that kind of... I'm just concerned about the daily reporting requirement.
Any comments?
No, I can understand that concern, particularly in the heat of battle, which is what this is. We're talking about during this period of time right before the election when this is going to be another burden, so I recognize that. We do have fax availability, but that may not always be helpful, depending on where you are and what you're doing.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Ms. Ruzick, how many fax machines are available and, through the Secretary of State's office, what kind of system is down there for fax capability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, we have what I'm told is the biggest, most powerful kind of fax machine that you can possibly have. It has hours and hours of memory. It holds reams and reams of paper because before filing deadlines, like on weekends, people will be faxing the reports in all weekend, and we'll have reams of reports by Monday morning. It has lots and lots of memory, so even if dozens and dozens of faxes are coming in at the same time, they'll all come in. The problem that people have, and it's sort of just the getting in line kind of problem is as they start to come in the last afternoon of a filing deadline, they when the reports are very long, we're talking about full C&E reports, that they can really line up. Now, for the kind of daily reports that we're talking about at the end here, I could be wrong, but I'm not anticipating that they're going to be that long because it's just the one-page type thing. Those could come in. We could get hundreds of them in an hour. So I don't know that would be so much of an issue, but we have not found that our faxing capability has been a hindrance to us. Usually, if there's problems with faxing, it's on the other side that faxes don't come out from the machine they started at.
We read that as your fax machine is a big, good one.
It's a big, good one. Well, we feel an obligation to have a big, good one because people rely on it so heavily.
Okay, thank you. Further, Representative Bridger.
I guess I have a question to ask. Is part of this to accommodate the staff at the other end here in Salem so that you can keep up with it? Because I don't see this as particularly accommodating to the candidate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it really doesn't accommodate the staff at all. I think the initial impetus for this was trying to brainstorm how to make this financial information more accessible and more valuable to the public. It really wasn't aimed at trying to be easier for candidates. It won't do that, I don't think. Nor does it make it easier for our staff, because instead of just two reports and then the one supplement coming in on the last day, we're asking for a lot. You know, we're asking for paper for a longer period of time. So I don't think we're doing something that's easier or more beneficial for either of those parties. Our real concern was the public disclosure. And as I know you're all very aware, there's, because of the Oregon Constitution and the way that the laws are in this state, there's very little we can do in the way of campaign finance regulation other than disclosure. And so our concept was, what can we do in a sort of a beneficial way to the public to make this information more available? It completely dovetails with what Representative Devlin said about electronic filing, because having the paper in our office is not the same as having the public really be able to have it. Although I will say that it's not just the media that asks for the reports. We get a lot of requests for the reports. So to answer your question, it wasn't for us, it wasn't for the staff, it wasn't for the candidates or PACs. It was for the public that we're suggesting this.
Follow-up, please. I guess my next question is there that much demand? Now, I know you say there's a lot of demand, but and I believe in the public's right to know. I don't want to argue that point. I just wonder is there more demand now from the public for this information on a more regular basis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think we could say that there is more demand. I mean, we do get a lot of requests for the reports. Of course, a lot of it comes from the campaigns themselves of people asking for their opponents' reports. But I mean, that's a means of public disclosure as well that I think is valuable, because people can use that for whatever reason they need it. We're not going to have a perfect system until we have a way to get the information directly to the public, because right now most of the information is screened through the media. They come, they look at them, and they choose which candidates to put in their articles and which contributions or expenditures to identify. And so we have that handicap. But at least if the reports are there in a timely basis, you know, to the extent that people do want them and are asking for them, they're there. So that's our purpose.
Thank you. Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rozick, I certainly agree with the concept here of shining more light into, one, the initiative process, and that the voters do not have information when they're in the midst of this. Secondly, moving the report date times up a week to correspond with the voter thing. Following up on Representative Devlin's thing, maybe we need to look at sort of three reporting levels in terms of the expenditure category, mm-hmm. in that of being statewide versus Senate, which is twice as big as the House, versus the House districts, and, you know, look at some sort of realistic number instead of the sort of arbitrary 500 that was chosen here. Aren't there some corresponding or were corresponding in law different levels of, I know for contributions at one time under the law that's now invalid, there were mm-hmm. different giving limits, for example.
Right.
You know, so. any ideas along that line?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, certainly we'd be very open to looking at that. I mean, as I say, you know, there was some thought that we should include expenditures because of the fairly long period of time that's involved and having no reporting at all. But I wouldn't say that we're wedded to the $500. I mean, certainly we could look at something that might be graduated based on what the race was. If that were the interest of the committee, we'd be happy to work with the committee on that.
Thank you. Representative Walker.
I would just like to make a comment about the daily filing here this last part of the campaign. When you're dealing with volunteers, and you live out in a rural area, and you're having to receive these by volunteers, and they have to be processed by volunteers, and they have to file a report daily. I think we'll have a volunteer revolt, because right now, as it is, keeping the books on some of these campaigns, I gave up. I hired an accountant. I said, forget this. But a lot of people can't do that. If you're running a small campaign in a rural area, most of them are run by volunteers, and they just cannot be doing these daily type things. It becomes an accounting process. If you have several checks come in on one day and they have to process those checks and then file a report, and the next day they have to process more checks and file a report, and they're doing that for a week, pretty soon they're wondering if they're going to have a job left by the time they get through their volunteer duties. That's just an observation I'd like to make on the record. It's very difficult with volunteers to do this.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, the only thing I would respond to that is that we were hopeful that by setting the level at $500 from a single contributor in a single day contributions, and then expenditures at the $500 level, that there would be many people that would never have to file a daily report, not at the legislative race level, perhaps, but at the local level. Because we're not distinguishing here, this is going to apply to all candidates, but the thought was that this would rarely apply to a school board candidate or a park and recreation district candidate or that sort of thing, because they're not receiving $500 contributions or making $500 expenditures. But as you say, I mean, it would be a challenge if you have the campaign that is receiving contributions over $500 from a single source after the cutoff period for the second pre, or making $500 expenditures. And so we're open, if we think that casts too wide of a net, we're open to discussing those levels, if the concept is something that the committee is willing to consider.
Thank you. Further questions? Franklin, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. I'd like to call up a panel of three: Kristen Leonard, OEA; Steve Lanning, AFL-CIO Oregon; Tricia Smith, OSEA. If you three would come forward, please. Welcome. I'll let the three of you determine which order you'd like to go in.
For the record, I'm Kristen Leonard with the Oregon Education Association, and I'm here to speak kind of on the first part of this bill, dealing with the initiative, contribution and expenditure reporting during signature gathering for an initiative. And the OEA is very supportive of the concept within this bill, but we do not feel like it gets at our concerns with reporting early enough or often enough during the circulation process. Currently, there are 25 initiatives introduced for the 2002 general election. Of those 25, three have already been approved for circulation. It'll probably be about another month or so, in which time the others would be allowed to go out and start gathering signatures. What this sets in place is a process by which signature gathering will be out on the streets. People will be asked to sign these petitions, and yet there will be no way to determine who is paying for this kind of activity until, under this bill, May of the following year. So the feeling is that there is over a year's worth of time in which political activities are taking place, and there's no disclosure of where the finances for those activities are coming from. As it stands right now, as candidates, you are all held at a much higher standard than the initiative campaigns are held. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are spent in this initiative signature gathering process. right now, kind of in the current market of signature gathering. It's $1 to $3 per signature. If you, you know, multiply, say, an average of $2 times 130,000 signatures that you'd need to gather, you're, you know, in over $200,000 that you're spending on one initiative in the signature gathering process. Currently, as it stands, there is no reporting whatsoever during the circulation process as to where that money is coming from, who's spending it, that sort of thing. And so it's our feeling that this is a great concept, but something needs to be done to make sure this happens earlier in the process and more often. We understand the Secretary of State's concerns with cost and workload, but we've also thought that maybe something where you accommodate the different timelines of the respective campaigns. So, you know, once you get out on the street, you start gathering signatures, you've made your first expenditures, or you've received your first contributions, then you've got a month or two by which you turn in a CNE report, and then from there on do something quarterly, monthly, whatnot, until you've turned in the signatures. So that's where we are as an organization, just more often and earlier.
Thank you. Mr. Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and we feel the same way. House Bill 2575 with the initiative disclosure takes a small step in the right direction, requiring disclosure a little bit earlier, but the initiative signature gathering campaigns are well underway, well funded by the time any of this comes out. This is just in the last couple of months of campaigns when this disclosure would finally take effect. We think that it needs to happen a lot sooner. It needs to happen, and I guess we sort of view an initiative campaign as having a primary election and a general election, just like candidates do. And once they're in the streets gathering signatures, that's the primary election. That's a big campaign, and it takes a lot of effort and a lot of resources, and currently we're not getting any reporting at all during that entire process, which is like the primary election for an initiative signature gathering effort. So we think that it needs to happen sooner. And I understand about workloads in the Secretary of State's office, and perhaps there could be a threshold, like candidates have a threshold. And if, for example, if the threshold is $2,000 and a campaign gets to that threshold, then reporting kicks in. And I think something like that would help keep the workload under control. But it definitely needs to happen sooner as far as we're concerned, and this is only a small step in the right direction, making it happen a month earlier. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I, too, am here to speak to the portion of House Bill 2575 that deals with contribution and expenditure reporting for initiative campaigns during the signature gathering portion of that campaign. The initiative didn't anticipate the industry that has grown up around it. And I think that that's why we don't see CNE reporting during a signature gathering phase, because in the old, good old days, there was not a $200,000 effort to get an initiative on the ballot. It was a group of individual citizens volunteering their time. Today, that's not the case. And as Kristen indicated, it is a very expensive process ordinarily and normally to put an initiative on the ballot. This is the only place that I know of in our campaign processes where you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and not have to report that you have done so to the public. And we think it's very important that reporting does occur during the signature gathering phase of an initiative. We do believe that House Bill 2575 does not go far enough by only reporting one, and that being around the primary before the deadline. We agree that with my colleagues here that there should be more reporting and more often reporting. We think that it should be triggered by an amount of money raised, and at that point then there should be regular reporting through the Secretary of State to the public of the amount of money that is raised and spent in a signature gathering effort. We think that it is not appropriate that a campaign can go on for over a year without the public knowing who is sponsoring that campaign and who is behind the effort. There is certainly a lot. It is just like your campaign in many, many ways. The media is tracking it. The public is aware of it. What they don't know is who's behind it. And we think it's very important that you do require reporting of contributions and expenditures during the signature gathering phase, and that it be done far more often than is suggested in House Bill 2575.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Next up, Bill Sizemore. Welcome.
Glad to be here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bill Sizemore, my assistant director of Oregon Taxpayers United. Becky Miller is here as well. She does most of our C&E work, contribution and expenditure reporting. So if I get stuck, I know where to turn. Thanks for letting me speak today to House Bill 2575. Just for kind of frame of reference, as you probably know, our organization has been involved at times with the initiative process, you might say maybe perhaps more so than anyone else. And we are familiar with the process, forwards and backwards, and a lot of the misrepresentations made about the process, misconceptions, therefore coming from that, such as that back in the early days they never dreamed that we would have these big paid signature drives, et cetera. Secretary of State at the time, Phil Kiesling, and I have made a number of joint appearances, and he has spoken on a number of times saying that that's malarkey, that in fact he said Sizemore's a cheapskate by the standards of what they paid for signature back in 1912, 1914, because they used paid petitioners right from the very beginning, because there have always been people who were shy, who were too busy, had families to raise and businesses to run, didn't have the personality type to stand on a street corner and collect signatures, and therefore gave money so someone else who had that time or personality type could do it for them. So money has always been in the process. But one thing to recognize about initiatives, and I'm going to say this as bluntly as I dare, the initiative process is not like candidates. The U.S. Supreme Court has said on a number of occasions that the same propensity for money to corrupt as is present with candidates is not present with initiatives. Why? Because initiatives say what they say. They do what they do. And you can read it and analyze it up front, but you don't know what a politician is going to say or do after they get elected. So you want to know who's given this guy or this gal money so they can run for office. Because you want to know if later they are saying or doing things differently than they were before when they were a candidate because of the monetary influence, the corrupting, or at least the potential of money to corrupt candidates after they are office holders, is not present with money, with initiatives, because they say the same thing before, they say the same thing after. That's not always true with politicians. Now, our organization does not object to disclosure. We have to disclose every dollar we get. And if we don't disclose it, we're fined and they come after the information. So it's never a case with us of hiding the information. The issue here is the... what's the motivation behind this bill? All it does to us is bury us with a whole bunch more paperwork. You know, our organization has about 22,000 members. When we put a measure on the ballot, often we will turn in C&E reports this thick.
Yeah, we've had them over almost 400 pages thick before.
And that does not include the contributors who gave $50 or less. Tremendous amount of paperwork, almost a full-time job for a very capable individual to disclose a bunch of information that nobody cares about, but the OEA, AFL-CIO, OSEA, OPEU, and a bunch of reporters from the Oregonian. The public doesn't care. I have no problem with telling you where money comes from, but the thing is that for us, for an organization like ours, the detail of information that is required is absolutely mind-boggling. how many checks that we get in from little contributors. Now, it would be interesting if the OEA would sign on, for example, to a version of this bill that says they have to disclose every contribution that they get. If the union donates money to a candidate or a cause, that they have to disclose the names and addresses of every one of those school teachers, or janitors or cooks or bus drivers at a school, every one of their names and addresses who gave money to the union in the form of dues that end up being contributed to candidates or measures, as well as the PAC contributions, so that all of their members' names can be listed there for the public to see. And they had to go through all that detailed work. That would be an interesting development in this bill, since they are careful not to let those addresses and names be publicly known. This bill is not necessary. It doesn't really do anything for the public. This is the bottom line, the question I ask. If this information was widely disseminated throughout the state, would it affect my ability to collect signatures necessary to put a measure on the ballot? The answer is no. Fill in any name of any donor that I have, and the answer is no. Put a badge on that says this petition is sponsored by Bill Sizemore. That's much worse than naming my donors, right? I mean, they do that. They say they this is a anti-Sizemore measure or whatever. I see my name all the time with a Bill Sizemore with a red circle and a slash through my name. That's supposed to scare off all those signers if they just knew who was really behind this. And yet, we placed 7 measures on the ballot in the last election, more than anyone has in the entire history of the initiative process in this country. This is only a burden upon those of us that use the process. And the more donors we have, the more it is a burden. Now, if you set some threshold and said that, you know, you got to have, if somebody gives you some large dollar amount, and the public needs to know that, we have to, you know, we get a $10,000 donation or something. I mean, that's what we would consider a large donation, $10,000 on up. If there's some significant number that you've got to know, $500, I mean, how many names? I mean, we have a lot of people that donate $500 or $1,000. We have a lot of people that donate $250 and $100. But to have to list all of those smaller donors, isn't there some threshold that if you're going to do this, it really does matter? And it isn't down there at $500. And we recommend that this bill, it's unnecessary. We disclose fully now. We don't mind having to disclose if there's some big contribution that everybody's got to know that you fill in the name, gave money to our cause, and you could fill in whatever name you choose. A lot of times people were surprised to find out that Mark Hemstreet's not even a donor to our organization, hasn't given us money in 4 or 5 years. You go, what? I thought you were a puppet on his, and he was pulling the strings. Well, you know, he's not even a donor. So maybe it would help us if people knew that Mark Hemstreet's not a donor to our organization. But the truth of the matter is, people don't care. I just to give you a better feel for this, I'm going to...
Excuse me, Mr. Sizemore, for a moment. Representative Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sizemore or Ms. Miller, this is more of a technical question in a sense. You indicated that, you know, when you file your existing reports that you have to file, they can be up to 400 pages long. You're filing a single report. If you file multiple reports, like over a period of time, like candidates do, your reports would be cumulative relative to totals, but not relative to contributors. So you'd be actually filing smaller reports as you went along the process. So would it actually be that much greater additional burden? I mean, as a candidate, I had to file all my reports 1 week before the election. I'm not saying July is 1 week before the election, but if I had to file them all 1 week before the election and had to do everything that I'd received since the beginning of the cycle, it would be a tremendous job. But since I'm reporting periodically, it's not as difficult a job. I mean, in the sense, you might be filing one 400-page report now, but if you had 2 or 3 reporting periods, you might be filing a 100-page report this time, 150-page the next time, but you wouldn't be listing contributors again that you'd listed from previous reports. You might be listing totals. Have you given any consideration to that?
Miller, I'm not sure you've identified yourself on the record yet. Could you do that, please?
Sure. I'm sorry. This is Becky Miller. I'm with Oregon Taxpayers United. Representative Devlin, obviously there is some merit to what you're saying, that when you have smaller reports, yes, each one is simpler than one large report. But the thing is, they're all computerized. You know, you spend all your time throughout the period inputting the information into the computer. So spitting out one big report and proofreading it really is ultimately easier than spitting out, you know, 20 reports during that same period and having to go through each one, remembering the deadlines, making sure, because, you know, with each report, it's not just that report. You then have they send you back a letter if there are any problems or questions, and then you have to correct that. And so sometimes you get a lot of short reporting times, and they start overlapping. You're making corrections to one report after you have had to submit the next report. And so then if your totals get off, you start having this cascading effect of corrections, and it can get so confusing so fast that I have literally had reports where neither the Secretary of State nor I had a clue what the numbers were supposed to be because they had overlapped so many times. And it really took major work to sit down and try and sort it out. You know, just a little addition error can just end up in a mess. And I pride myself in having very good reports. So I can imagine with smaller committees that aren't used to this sort of thing, how completely confusing that would be. When you get down to the general election time as it is, you know, we have stacked up deadlines. You get, you know, every month, and then right at the end you've got, you know, every day pretty much, and then right after, and then, you know, start. So within those, the corrections to the original reports, as I said, overlap when you have the next report. It can be really horrible. So if you've got to do that throughout the initiative process, too, with circulating petitions, it just makes for a consistent nightmare instead of a brief one.
Mr. Chairman, just conclude with Mr. Devlin. Don't underestimate, unless you've done these reports yourself, the problem with the aggregate contributions. We have about 23,000 members of our organization, and so we send out a fundraising letter, and then a few months later we'll send out another one, and they may send you $10, $25, $50, $100, and you don't report them as an individual donor because they're under $50 until their aggregate gets over $50. Then you have to go back and search previous reports and now list this person as a donor by name and address, even though they've been previously listed only in a lump sum. And that really tends to make the multiple reports even more complex and more burdensome.
I understand that issue, having done quite a few of the reports myself. But the bill in front of us advocates one additional reporting period, and I think there are other people who have testified advocating for more than one additional. Obviously, your preference would be to have only the one that you have right now. But there would be a range of how burdensome these might be, wouldn't there? I mean, if you had two additional, that might be, you know, one level of burden. You talked in your last response about filing 20 reports, and I don't think anybody's advocating 20 reports. But the level of burden would be dependent on how many additional reports.
Right. Well, over a course of a year, or 2 years, an election cycle, you could end up with 20 versus 5. The point here, though, is when you get to the end of the initiative drive, is what I'm understanding here, you end up with daily reporting right at the very end, which, you know, in an initiative drive is the time when you're under the most crunch anyway, because you've got signatures pouring in at, you know, a huge level higher than they have the entire time before. So you're inundated in your office with signatures that you're sorting out and dealing with, and at the same time trying to, you know, get these reports going through, it can really put a strain on everybody. So from that respect, I would have to say it is more burdensome, especially right at the end with these extra reports.
Thank you for the question. Would you like to give us a summation here right quickly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know anytime you talk about disclosure, everybody says, I'm for all that, let all the light shine down and let the public know as much as possible. I believe, which I say this without hesitation, frankly, almost nobody cares. about where the money comes for initiative drives. And we have to disclose it all now. And before people vote, they know. Months before they vote, all the information about where the money came from knows. People know it. If you think that I have to argue with you if you think that letting them know in advance will stop people from signing petitions that they otherwise would have signed. I was beginning to say a moment earlier, if you had a sign, if you had a guy from Alabama sitting at a shopping center with a big 4x8 sheet of plywood, white with big block red letters painted on the sign, says, "I'm from Alabama, I don't give a rip about Oregon, and I'm getting $5 a signature. Sign here to lower your property taxes." You know what? They sign if they want to lower their property taxes. Doesn't make any difference if he's from Alabama, if he's getting paid, or he's a volunteer. Doesn't matter whether he likes the cause he's circulating for or not. People sign and vote on these things because they like the idea or not. Bill Sizemore's for it? Great. Bill Sizemore's for it? Not so great. They like it? They sign. It's just not an issue. This bill proposes to fix a problem that doesn't really exist. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. That takes care of our witness list. Anybody here want to add anything to this? Feel free to come forward if you do. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I'm David Buchanan. I'm the Executive Director for Oregon Common Cause. Our organization is made up of those almost nobodies who don't seem to be a large enough number to matter in this instance. But I think they do, and I think that not only the people who do care, the significant number of people who do care, also stand in for a larger number who might want to care at some point and would like to be able to have the opportunity to find the information if it occurs to them that this is something they'd like to know before an election. The numbers, you could just kind of speculate, you know. I mean, some people care a lot. A few hundred people care enough to run for office. Some people, a few thousands of people care enough to sign a petition. But when it comes time to voting, there's thousands, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands out there. And if they want a bit of information about what process led them to the choices they have in front of them on a ballot, an initiative petition or a candidate, if that person wants some additional information before they cast that vote, they should have the right to be able to secure that information. And if they don't know about it ahead of time, they're not going to ask for it. Over the years, we've had a system that's kind of evolved. The reports get filed, the paperwork gets filed with the Secretary of State. The news media come in and do some reports. Generally, they just hit the highlights. But the public sees those highlights, and it triggers something. Oh, that information is available. I wonder about this race or that other race or this ballot measure or that other ballot measure. If a story on one initiative or candidate race prompts a question about where's the money for this candidate coming, a voter typically will think, well, I wonder how that would affect a particular candidate that I'm interested in. Maybe I can call that candidate. Maybe I could call that candidate's opponent and find out. But if the information isn't available, the voter is at a dead end. There's no place for them to find the information at a time when they may wish to find it. I mean, I know that the public isn't down there standing at the doors of the Secretary of State's office when the reports are filed demanding to see them. But the press does that, and the public has learned to rely on the press for the highlights of that information, and depending on the process, and they're dependent on the process that they know the information is available. What this bill attempts to do is to make the information a little bit more available, a little bit more readily available, and it adds a new step in the initiative process of making information available before the signature deadline. That's an important step for the public to be able to understand a little bit more about where an initiative is coming from. I think Mr. Sizemore makes a point. Yes, lots of people don't care. Some do. A number do. An important number do. A crucial number care about this information and would like to have it and would like to have it available. My main point is that when you use the word the public, it's a pretty big collective noun, and it refers to lots of people, and there's a wide range of interest in that public. Some care a lot, and those people who have the right and the duty in the public system, a public process like ours, have the right to this information, and it should be available to them for that purpose. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you. Representative Garrard, please.
One of the problems I have with this is the $500 threshold, and that I think it causes too much reporting. What, in your opinion, would be the threshold of a contributor's amount that would trigger for you? I want to know whether it's 5,000, 1,000, or 500. Where in your mind do you become concerned when you see a contributing amount that goes over a certain amount? I realize that varies from race to initiative, et cetera, but I'd like to know where you are on that.
Well, it's a terrific question, and one of the things that it puts me in mind of is when I first started looking at elections, House races were run for $5,000, Senate races were run for $10,000. In those days, a $50 contribution was significant. $100 or several hundred dollars was a pretty big deal. Nowadays, with this enormous escalation of costs, these smaller amounts seem like a pretty small amount, and proportionately they are a tiny amount from the large scale hundreds of thousands of dollar races that are going on in the legislative races in this day and age. I think that there's a certain point to be made by this scale, but one of my goals is to help reduce that scale and to bring about some limitations on the amount of money so that there isn't an unlimited arms race of who can outspend the opponent. I wouldn't want to set a dollar limit on that. A few years ago in the early 90s, we advocated a ballot measure that put a $500 limit on contributions. I was comfortable with that. I think that reporting is something that the more transparent the process is, the better. And if it were feasibly, technically possible, I think all contributions should be reported and made known. But in a compromise with the vagaries of reality, we cut the limit off and say, well, under a certain amount, we should not worry about the effect of that. And I agree, and I think in the real world that's fine. But I'm interested in kind of keeping those numbers as low as possible. I think that reporting is important, and the more reporting, the better. The few people who complain about the too much reporting, the candidates and the people who have file reports for initiatives, nobody forced them to get into the business. They voluntarily chose to adopt this task of running for office, of promoting an initiative. And as long as it's a voluntary system, I think that it's not too onerous to report the information of the process of how you're seeking to win that election. So I wouldn't be interested in trying to raise those limits and say, well, above that limit it's important and below that limit it's not. It can be important at almost any level. I'm happy to kind of accommodate the realities of paperwork and all of those things, and that's why, you know, the way that we have it now with this below a certain level, you don't have to worry about it. But I'm not interested in trying to alter that. I'd rather reform the other end of the system and put some limits on the total amount that's being spent.
Thank you for your...
Thank you for the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, that takes care of our list today. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2575 and committee. It's been a great day of good testimony here, and I hope you'll give this some thought. Please contact me when you win and if you have any particular thoughts about this, this measure. All right, we are going to open a work session on House Bill 2171. You have seen this before. And this is Representative Walker's bill. And if I could have Lynn Rossett come forward, please.
Members, we should have adopted two amendments at your spot.
This was a bill that was relating to write-in elections, and one that was going to require the individual who was seeking the nomination by write-in to fish or cut bait at a certain point and let everybody know what their intentions were about accepting the nomination. I think a question that I had initially here, Glenn, was on page 6 of the Dash 2 Amendments, subsection 9. There's a term used there that I wasn't very familiar with, and we're joined by Representative Vicki Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sprint down those stairs very well.
Well, we'll let you get your breath there while we let Lynn answer the question about the Dash 2s, page 6, subsection 9. I'm going to read that to you, and then I would like to ask for amplification on one area. In the case of a recount involving a candidate nominated or elected by write-in votes, the first demand shall be filed with the office of the Secretary of State not later than the 55th day, a first supplemental demand not later than the 65th day, and a second supplemental demand not later than the 70th day after the date of the election in which votes were cast for the nomination for office. Can you explain to me what we're talking about when we talk about the first demand, first supplemental demand, second supplemental demand, and so forth?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lynn Rosick from the Elections Division. Yes, I can. What that's referring to is the way that we do demand recounts in Oregon is that you don't have to ask for a full recount of the race. You can ask for 5% of the precincts to be recounted as your first demand. Usually this is done so that people can test, make sure the equipment was working correctly, check out a precinct that they thought they would do better in, and just to see whether there's something kind of wacky about that precinct. And then the law allows that you can make a second demand of 10% of the precincts. And then once you've done those two partial recounts, then the last demand is to have the entire electoral district recounted. Now, by law, just to clarify, you cannot use those 5% and 10% recounts in order to be meshed with the original count. You're just using those as testing, and if you see there's something changing in the numbers, then you have to ask for a full demand before it can be overturned. So that's where that language comes from about first, second, and final demands.
Okay, thank you. Representative Devlin.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the other reason, too, is that usually in this case, it's, of course, not an automatic recount.
Right.
And the candidate or someone other has to pay for those partial recounts and ultimately probably would have to pay for the full recount. Once the full recount reverses the decision of the election or the election result actually changes, not just simply a change in a few votes, mm-hmm. but the winner changes,
right.
then the state has to pick mm-hmm. up the cost of the recount.
All right, let me just ask committee members if you have any questions about any specific areas of that bill. Representative Walker, would you like to add anything to this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Representative from Health District 41. No, I think the amendments are great. I was pleased that my colleague, Representative Devlin, raised that question because it's not anything that I had thought about, mm-hmm. nor alleged counsel. And I thought it was just my typical colleague being a little picky, but in this case, being a little picky was being very cautious, and I really appreciate that. And wanted to let you know that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mm-hmm. If you want to know about picky, talk to Representative Schrader, who was before the committee.
Just briefly, to bring us back up to speed, Representative Walker, could you give us the scenario of your race and the difficulty. I think the difficulty you had in your race regarding a write-in candidate had some effect on your bringing this forth. Could you just briefly, in a couple of minutes here, refresh us on what that was, what happened, mm-hmm. And why you brought this?
Sure, Mr. Chair. The reason I brought this forward is because I had an opponent who was written in on under a major political party. So I was a Democrat, he was a Republican. The statute did not address what would happen, did not address timelines for major political party candidates to declare their candidacy. And so I was concerned about that, called Secretary of State's office, and they said, well, we'll just arbitrarily say yes, just accept within 30 days. Well, that's arbitrary. That's a decision they made. It should be a decision that's in statute. It should be very clear in statute. So my opponent ended up accepting within like 7 days, I believe, of being sent notice. But it's otherwise, the way the statute read, he could have not accepted until the end of August, when other candidates of minor political parties are on the ballot. And I just found that to be unacceptable. So also, as part of the change, the Association of County Clerks determined that they would like to make the language broader and include any candidate for any office, because for local offices as well as state offices. And they found that to be a real helpful change for them. So it's actually fortuitous this happened, because we could just clean up the statute all the way around.
Lynn, any comments on that from your...
No. Chair Wilson, I would just echo what Representative Walker has said, is that we were interested, once the concept was raised about putting in a deadline for acceptance of a write-in candidate, and it is a useful addition to the statute, because it gives us a firm deadline that we can tell the write-in nominees about, so that they will answer. If they don't answer by that day, then we'll notify the party that they have a vacancy in their nomination, and they can proceed from there. And we thought it was useful as well to extend that to across the board to all candidates, rather than limit it to state candidates. So I think that the bill works for the Elections Division the way the -2 amendments are drafted.
And, Mr. Chair, if I might add to that, Ms. Rossick brought up a good point. My opponent had won the Republican nomination, but had he chosen to not accept it, then it fell on the Republican Party of the county to come up with another candidate. The sooner they can do that, the more beneficial for them. So if the write-in candidate takes until the end of August to make a decision whether to accept or not, it puts a burden on the local party to find a candidate who can be credible. So.
Great. Any final comments from any members of the committee here? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Very good. I get gun-shy with the representative. Okay. Thank you. Well, I would be happy to accept a motion. Representative.
Mr. Chairman, are we in more session yet?
Yes, we are. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I move the -2 amendments into HB 2171.
Representative Dudley moves the -2 amendments into House Bill 2171. Any discussion? All right. If you will call the roll, please.
Representative Dudley?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Mr.
Chairman.
Representative Dublin.
I move House Bill 2171 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Dublin moves House Bill 2171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Right, call the roll.
Representative Dublin?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Excuse.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
And motion carries. And as a carrier, Representative Vicki Walker, if you would.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost answered all of Representative Walker on my vote there. All right, thank you very much, committee.
Thank you. All right, we will close that work session on House Bill 2171, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 185. And committee, if you would stand fast here, I'd like to get through this relatively quickly. That is my hope today. I'd like to move this if it works. Oh, and yes, while I do have you as well, I think all of you are aware of the heavy lifting. We have to do it 4 o'clock this afternoon. I apologize for that, but we do need to get back together for a very few short minutes at 4 o'clock to amend House rules to add a new committee to deal with Measure 7. So that's what we're doing at 4 o'clock. We'd appreciate a quorum. We'll need that. And I promise I'll get you out of here quickly. Okay. Yes, I did. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 185. And our guest is Paul Romaine. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney from Portland, and I represent the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association. Senate Bill 185, little background information. It comes to you from, obviously, the Senate, where it passed unanimously. Back in 1989, this legislative body, at the request of the oil heat industry, set up what's called the Oil Heat Commission. The Oil Heat Commission was designed to basically help people deal with oil tank problems, and it was funded by an assessment on the oil heat industry. In 1997, through the infinite wisdom of this body, that Oil Heat Commission was abolished. It was actually, the move was to try and move people more towards natural gas, if you really want to know the problem. A decision which looked good in 1997, but is increasingly looking not so good. But we're not here to debate that issue. In wrapping up, the legislature cut off the assessment date, basically, in October 4, 1997. The Oil Heat Commission, which had the authority to set its assessment, met prior to October 4 and set a zero assessment for the period of time from August 1 to October 4. Fine. Now we fast forward to 2000, actually December of 2000, when I receive a phone call from the Secretary of State Audits Division, where they say there's been a mistake. The procedure followed, just procedure, they still had the authority to do it. The procedure followed by the now defunct Oil Heat Commission was in error. So that assessment that was zero actually reverts back to the old assessment numbers that were prior to that time. And your clients are getting letters tomorrow totaling about $172,000, which they now owe to the Oil Heat Commission, which, by the way, is defunct. We think the Secretary of State's office thought that they had no alternative, which they didn't. It was the right move for them to make. But they also said to us, look, we don't really think this is, you might want to do something about it at the legislature. So they've been working with us, and they've sort of held back. They sent out the assessments, and they actually have been hoping that nobody sends them in, but about 40-some people have already sent in their money. What this bill does is cancel the assessment for that two-month period of time, August 1 to October 4, 97, and it refunds any of the assessments that were made during that period. That's all the bill does. I'd be happy to answer any questions. We hope for your speedy passage of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Again, questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have no one else who has signaled that they would want to testify, and so I will close the public hearing on Representative Devlin.
No, my daughter.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 185, and I think I better open a work session on Senate Bill 185. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 185 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves Senate Bill 185 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? Right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Devlin?
Aye.
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Excuse. Representative Lurie?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Starr?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Walker?
Aye.
Representative
Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And do we have a volunteer carrier? This will be...
I'll carry.
Representative Cheryl Walker will carry. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 185, and we will open work session on House Bill 2061.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Starr. Representative Doyle.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2061 without recommendation to the Agriculture and Forestry Committee, then to Ways and Means.
So moved by Representative Doyle. Do we have any discussion? Any objection?
Could I have Representative Doyle's reason?
Representative Doyle, would you like to give a reason or would you like to defer to the chair on that?
If I can defer to the chair, I'd be happy to.
Fine. Yeah, we're simply moving this to another committee. We're moving it over to agriculture. Closely relates to what they do. And I think they already...
Mr. Chair, Representative Guerrero, the Agriculture Committee already has a bill that deals with the state fair and the racing issue. The Speaker's office asked us to put the bills together.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. All right, we have that motion, and we have called for discussion, and I'll ask if there are any objections. All right. So moved. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2061. Again, we meet at 4 o'clock, and I promise we'll get out of here just as quickly as possible.
Chairman, could we be sure you have a quorum?
That's a great idea, Representative Berger.
Who's not coming?
Who's not?
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Appreciate that. We'll adjourn.